This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, local students held a rally this morning to oppose standardized testing.
The Postal Service has announced that it will cut Saturday delivery of mail.
And the Federal Reserve has admitted that the hacker group Anonymous breached its security on Sunday.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 6, 2013. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Nia Lewis. Today, students in Portland, Oregon joined a press conference opposing standardized testing. Teachers at One Washington High School are already refusing to administer statewide assessment tests, calling them a waste of time and money. There's been growing support among parents, students, and other schools for putting an end to standardized tests. The Portland Student Union says that Oregon's assessment tests are not an accurate measure of student achievement or quality of teaching, and that scores are highly correlated with race and class rather than individual student ability. Student unions of Portland Public Schools announced their opt-out campaign this morning in front of the Robert Blanchard Education Service Center. They asked students to exercise their rights not to take the statewide standardized test and prove their proficiency using other approved methods. KBOO's Jamie Partridge was there and brings us this report.
I'm here because I've never done well in standardized testing, and I don't think that one test should define what happens in the classroom and what my schools are able to teach me. I have really good grades, but my tests have never reflected that, my standardized testing, but I'm planning to go to a four-year college, and I'm planning to graduate, and I'm not letting standardized testing stop me from that, and I am opting out. I have always struggled with reading, but I've always been at my level, but I've just had to go at my own pace. The state's always telling me that I'm in need of improvement, and that my teachers are in need of improvement, and that my schools are in need of improvement, but I can read, and I don't think the state should be telling me that I can't and telling me that my teachers aren't teaching me well enough and my schools aren't doing well enough. For writing, the state requires you to spend 3 days, which for our block schedule is a week or a week and a half, and curriculum's already cut down so much because of our block schedules, and now it's even cut down anymore, and we were in the middle of a lesson, but we had to stop because the state tells us we need to spend 3 days on a writing test, so we forgot everything we learned, and we had to, jump back and, do more days, and it's just not okay.
These tests also are taking up our class time. They want our schools to be better, but at the same time, that we're just using up our time we could learn to just take these tests that doesn't do anything for us personally. For my English teacher specifically, we have to take our writing sample this week, and that's going to take up the whole week, a couple days. But he was worried that some of us might not pass it, so we also had to take a full day of class just to take a work sample, just in case we might fail the writing assessment. And that's unfortunate that we have to take up all that class time when we should be working on things for the rest of the year. We have this huge paper we're going to write, but we didn't discuss that. We're not working on that. We're worried about state testing. Hopefully, our teachers are evaluated correctly.
Our schools are suffering due to bad test scores or inaccurate representations then of these test scores saying that this school needs help, where our school really does need help. These test scores might not say so, for they are manipulated in that way so that it's easier for the numbers to get shifted around and for us to get ignored, and we don't want that. We need to be heard.
And when you know about the situation with the Garfield High School teachers in Washington State, what do you think about that?
I think it's great that the whole community, and the teachers especially, are supporting this. They understand that this is taking up their class time. It's a waste of time and money for everyone.
And what is your goal today? I've heard something about 5%.
if we get 5% of those who are supposed to take these standardized tests to opt out, then our school will get a needs improvement kind of score, which we know our schools already need improvement. So really, we are only trying to show that these numbers do not actually reflect properly that we need improvement. We need that improvement regardless of these test scores, and they are a waste of our time.
My name is Paul Wells. I'm here speaking on behalf of the Portland Student Union, a federation of student unions representing youth across the Portland area. We are here today to kick off our campaign against what most represents educational austerity, privatization, and standardization. Against high-stakes testing as a practice and as a policy of evaluating and punishing schools and their respective communities. Not only does the administering of these tests waste millions of dollars in public resources, they waste the quality educational time we could be having with our teachers. In the place of high-stakes testing, we want a more holistic system of education that brings communities together, that brings parents, students, and members directly a part of the educational process together in evaluation. That's real education reform. It's reform from the bottom up.
I'm Tyler Opiela Young. I go to Metropolitan Learning Center. I'm opting out on moral principle. Standardized tests create inequalities, not just socioeconomically, but in terms of our own education. Where is our civics test? Where is our history test? Where is our music test? All these things are being pushed to the side in favor of our math and our reading and writing. I'm not saying that any are more or less important, but I believe that these standardized tests are creating inequalities across the field.
Hi, my name is Bill Kelly. I am a proud father of Katie Kelly, who represents Lincoln here today. Speaking as a father, as a taxpayer, and also as someone who's worked for the last 12 years to provide services to schools all over the country, I can tell you that the unfunded mandates of No Child Left Behind have unnecessarily diverted resources away from personalized local learning and into a testing regimen that is of dubious value. So I say it's high time that the students themselves are speaking up and acting on their experience, and I'm really proud of them and support them.
As a parent, one of the things we try to teach our children is that when you're wrong or you make a mistake, you own that. And you try to, you know, rectify that mistake. So we are asking Governor Kitzhaber to acknowledge that, you know, these tests are wrong, they are not equitable, and Governor Kitzhaber needs to, you know, change how these tests are administered, and fix the mistake. Thank you.
Hi, so my name is Lexia Garcia, and I'm a senior at Lincoln High School, and I'd just like to say thank you to everyone that came out today to support, and all the juniors that spoke, all the parents, all the community members that spoke today. We'd like to encourage everyone to opt out of taking their standardized tests, and solidarity!
Solidarity!
Those were students and parents in front of the Portland Public Schools Administration Building speaking out against Oak's standardized testing.
Regular listeners of the KBOO News will recognize the name of Debbie Austin, a woman who fought to save her home from a fraudulent foreclosure for months. She and her husband and their two kids did end up getting forcibly evicted last month, but they have continued the fight to stop illegal foreclosure evictions in Oregon. First, they led a two-day sit-in protest at the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office 2 weeks ago, and this week, Debbie Austin and her supporters headed to Eugene to confront the corporate lawyer hired by mortgage company Fannie Mae to carry out foreclosures in Oregon. KBOO's Jacob Soderberg spoke with Karen Devers, who was part of yesterday's delegation to Eugene.
What was the content of the letter that you read?
We stated that we were in support of Debbie Austin, that we would like to have her reinstated in her home, and that we also would like his support to have a moratorium on foreclosures and evictions in the state of Oregon. And considering his position as Fannie Mae affiliate, we thought that would be appropriate for him to at least voice his interest in that and his support in that kind of an action.
And did he voice his support?
No, he did not.
So what was the response of David Cox, the representative of Fannie Mae in Oregon, to your delegation?
We came into his office, and we were very respectful and very quiet. We did have some signs, but as I said, there were only 12 of us. So we came to the lobby. We asked to speak with him. we weren't sure if he would actually come down and see us, because sometimes people don't in that kind of a situation. But he did. He came down. He kind of kept his distance. And we explained that we had a letter that we would like to give to him. We handed him the letter. And then we said we would like to read it out loud, which is what we usually do. And he responded that, no, he didn't want the letter read out loud, and that we should leave, and he was going to call the police. So we did just calmly read the letter, reassured him that that's all we wanted to do. So we read the letter and also left with him a list that had thousands of names in support of the action. He went around and took pictures of us while we were reading the letter, and then that's it. And then we calmly left, and we never saw the police, so I'm not sure what happened with that.
And can you tell us about what is the current situation of Debbie Austin and her family's home?
They are no longer able to get into their home. They were evicted, and there are armed guards, private militias that are paid by the taxpayers. And typical cost for the number of people that they have there is between $400 and $600 a day. And that comes out to about $14,000 a month, which is over 10 times what her mortgage was.
And I understand that that the Austin family actually did make their mortgage payments. How is it they ended up getting evicted?
They did make their payments, and it was really just actually kind of an amazing error that was created not by the Austins, but by the bank. And the bank did not have accurate records. And when Debbie Austin showed that she had made the payment, and that, you know, the records were there, the check was cashed, and all that, but they still foreclosed and evicted her.
And how is that legal?
I have no clue. I have no idea. And that's one reason why we're asking for a moratorium and saying that, you know, when things like this are going on and people, good people, are making every effort to follow the rules, and they are still, you know, bullied and treated in illegal and fraudulent ways, this has got to stop.
Again, I've been speaking with Karen Devers with We Are Oregon. She was part of a delegation yesterday to Eugene with David Cox, the representative of Fannie Mae foreclosures in Oregon. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Hundreds of citizen lobbyists paid visits to their Oregon state legislators earlier this week, calling for universal health care in the state of Oregon. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Jennifer Blackburn, an organizer from Healthcare for All Oregon, about what's happening at the state level on the single-payer option.
Can you briefly recap for us what transpired at the state capitol earlier this week?
So for about 6 months, we've known that the first day in Salem was going to be February 4th, and that we were going to go make a presence and let our representatives know how we feel about the healthcare system and what we'd really like them to be doing. About 1,000 of us showed up on Monday from all over the state, and we rallied and heard from Michael Dembro, some other speakers, some other people that work for the state, and then also other activists and volunteers, and also saw a live performance by Norman Sylvester singing The Healing of the Healthcare Blues, which was just a wonderful moment. And then afterwards, we broke apart and then made appointments or met with our representatives. We are working on something that we've been working on for years now. Last time we lobbied last year was for HD 3510, and this year it's going to be changed a little bit, and right now it's just a legislative concept, but we're creating basically our own Healthcare for All Oregon Act, and Michael Dembro has written this act up. There's 19 co-sponsors for it, for the bill, and the bill number should be coming out this month.
And how can people who want to get involved at a local level find out more?
You know, one main website right now, it, www.hcao.org. There's a lot of great information there. We do have a hired organizer. There are lots of individual groups in the Portland area and all over that you can get involved in that usually have monthly meetings. Everyone's very receptive. Email Ross, email HCAO, tap in, and, you know, just ultimately realize that we are all lobbyists and that we can all, you know, take this in our own hands by writing letters to our representatives, sending photos. For example, I'm sending a photo to my representative of a fundraising jar that had a picture of a little girl diagnosed with a heart problem, and her family was raising money. I took a picture of that. I'm going to send it to my representative, and ultimately what I'm trying to share with people so they can visualize this is that I'm ready. I'm ready to fund that one jar in order to cover everybody. It's just trying to get past these roadblocks we're putting up for ourselves and ultimately understanding that we need to change how we pay for this system, and it all needs to go into one pool. That's what single payer is.
Jennifer Blackburn of Healthcare for All, Oregon. Thanks for your time.
On Friday, hundreds of gun rights supporters plan to rally outside of Oregon State Capitol, and many of them will be armed. Oregon has some of the nation's least restrictive laws about carrying guns. It is one of fewer than 10 states that allow someone with a concealed handgun license to bring a weapon, hidden or exposed, and loaded or unloaded, into the Capitol building. Although an organizer says there are no plans to march inside the building, Capitol officials are bracing for the possibility of armed visitors roaming its halls, meeting rooms, and offices. Oregon State Police say they're beefing up security, as they would do for any big rally at the Capitol. Some committees are holding hearings at that time, and most lawmakers are expected to be in the building. One school canceled a tour of the Capitol when school officials learned of the rally. Other groups shrugged it off, including the Portland Opera, which will be performing at noon in the Rotunda. The rally is called Patriot Party at the Oregon Capitol Building and will take place this Friday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. No single group is sponsoring the rally, which is mainly being promoted on Facebook.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation is urging the Supreme Court to block a Maryland law requiring the collection of DNA from everyone arrested for a crime. The group said in a recent brief that law enforcement should be required to get a warrant before forcing people to give genetic samples. The case Maryland versus King challenges a law in the state of Maryland requiring DNA collection from all arrestees, whether they are ultimately convicted of a crime or not. The EFF points out that it is against the Fourth Amendment to retain DNA samples and repeatedly search them to check if the owner is involved in other crimes. Joseph Gallivan talked to Jennifer Lynch, staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, about the case and what happens to DNA records.
Now, the interesting thing about DNA collection is that the state argues that it's necessary to collect DNA to truly identify somebody who's been arrested. However, in most cases, when the state collects a DNA sample, it takes anywhere between 30 and 90 days to process that sample. And so that's too much time to use it for identification purposes. It's really used to try and match the person's DNA to past crime scenes and also to any future crime scenes.
And that DNA information is stored, and if the person is let go and not charged with a crime, what happens to that information?
Well, it depends on the state. Some states have expungement provisions, which allows the person whose DNA was collected to try and get the state to destroy it. But in general, those provisions are pretty complicated, and you have to show that you were not convicted, that you've gone through a full legal process and the state has not charged you with a crime and convicted you. And it can take a really long time. And if you are poor and represented by a public defender, that part of your criminal case is not included in what the public defender is doing for you. So you have to do that on your own. And most people just don't have the wherewithal to challenge the retention of their DNA.
And as it stands in one of those states, they can keep your DNA record indefinitely?
Yep, the state can retain the sample, which contains all of your genetic information, everything from what you look like to what diseases you might get in the future to who you're related to. All of that information is in your DNA sample. Mm-hmm. And then the state also retains the DNA profile, which is a smaller number or a smaller proportion of the genome that's used for identification purposes.
If they have your sample, does that mean they can run your sample against other DNA found at other crimes?
They can run the profile against
right.
any DNA profile that's in the database. It really is up to the state what they do with the DNA sample. In general, state laws allow for the storage and retention of the sample, but in general don't allow any other kind of sequencing or analysis of the sample. So most of the work is done with the profile. Well, I think it's a huge privacy issue. The way that our government is set up in the United States is to give the power to the people. And I think when the government has all of this information on a very large percentage of the population, it really shifts the power away from the people and to the government.
So you're saying the usage in the future could be not related to crime, but could be for some other kind of profiling?
It could be. The government is writing its own laws to determine what happens with the sample and could change the laws at any point in the future.
That was Jennifer Lynch, staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, talking about DNA collection and retention by law enforcement.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News later this hour, followed by Treasures from the KBOO Archives at 6, featuring a 1977 show by KBOO legend George Page.
So when you say, you know, how come you didn't come to us, what is it like to be in that bubble, especially as you reflect back and see the direction you went in and regret it?
Party has been one of the let me
describe that bubble to you for what I perceive to be the bubble around President Obama right now.
Something out of
and the man he's nominated to be CIA director, John Brennan.
Probably went hungry.
What's happening with drone strikes around the world right now is, in my opinion, as bad a development as
that's George Page speaking in 1977 on
KBOO. So
you can hear the full interview at 6, followed by a speech by the radical black comedian Dick Gregory. At 7 o'clock, it's KBOO's Black History Month special with guest Tariq Alit Nasheed. And keep listening for the latest local music on Drinking from Puddles at 8. Tomorrow's weather should be rainy with a high of 45 degrees.
It's 5:24 in the post-meridian. Time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Peg Cece knows that it's not enough to work hard in these perilous financial times, but you also have to work smart. And that's exactly what she's doing on behalf of American taxpayers. Well, not as common taxpayers, but uncommonly rich ones. They are private equity hucksters who make fabulous incomes by using other rich people's money to take over corporations, fire thousands of employees, sell off chunks of the entity, and siphon out profits for themselves and their rich investors. Also, Peg Cece is not a person, but PEGCC, the acronym for a lobbying group called the Private Equity Growth Capital Council. PEG is hard at work on Capitol Hill to protect its Wheeler Dealer members, including their national poster boy, Mitt Romney, from having their taxes hiked. Incredibly, their tax rate has been a mere 15%, lower even than what teachers and factory workers pay. But now, with Congress threatening to whack Social Security and Medicare, these privileged ones can't justify their low rate and are in danger of being treated, oh, the unspeakable horror of it, like commoners. Peg knows that last year's exposure of Romney's private equity profiteering and tax dodging has made the continuation of such pampering politically untenable. So this year, the group is smartly shifting from outright opposition to minimization of any, quote, burden on their phenomenal wealth. Raise the rate just a little bit, their lobbyists are quietly telling lawmakers, and delay the implementation of the increase so our lawyers can carve out loopholes and build more escape hatches, such as offshore tax shelters and phony corporate fronts. This is Jim Hightower saying, what's on display here is the raw selfishness of the entitled rich. To keep up with our tax-dodging scams, connect with Citizens for Tax Justice at www.ctj.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Federal Reserve has admitted that they were hacked by Anonymous on Sunday. The hack resulted in the release of personal information of over 4,000 banking executives, including encrypted passwords. Operation Last Resort, a Twitter account affiliated with Anonymous, announced the hack on Sunday. The Federal Reserve called the incident mild in nature and said it, quote, did not affect critical operations. While all the hacked passwords have been reset, the personal information will likely be used in social engineering attacks. Having executives' personal information makes such attempts to trick them into revealing sensitive information more likely to succeed.
Postmaster General Patrick Donahue has announced that the Postal Service will discontinue Saturday mail as of August, despite protests from letter carriers, farmers, and members of Congress. Congress has, in fact, voted to retain the six-day mail week. However, because the federal government has designated cutting Saturday service as a temporary measure rather than as an appropriations bill, Donahue has the go-ahead to cut service. Reasons behind cutting Saturday service include a major budget gap for the Federal Postal Service, but critics claim that the budget gap exists because the Postal Service is required to pay health benefits to workers who have not yet retired, which no other federal agency has been required to do. Donahue says that the change in service days will reflect the changing postal system itself, a system that is becoming increasingly underutilized with the advent of email and other forms of online communication. Congress members, as well as letter carriers, have expressed concern that ending Saturday service will be bad for local economies. For more on this story, here's Jamie Partridge, retired letter carrier and KABU reporter.
As a former letter carrier of 28 years, it's a huge blow to the letter carrier craft. That means one-sixth of the letter carriers' jobs will be eliminated. And this is on top of a 27% pay cut that the new low seniority letter carriers received in the contract arbitration that was just handed down here last week. These city carrier assistants, as they're called, some of them have been worked as long as 5-6 years, have seen their wages slashed, and now they're looking at losing their jobs. Congress has, since 1983, guaranteed six-day delivery as part of their continuing resolutions on the budget. But apparently the Postmaster General has found a loophole in the latest continuing resolution, and he says that he can, as soon as August, eliminate Saturday delivery. Well, that's outrageous. This is a phony crisis, the financial crisis that the Postal Service is experiencing, and the Postmaster General is driving forward with this, driving the Postal Service into a death spiral by eliminating services. It's phony. The Postmaster General knows that he should be waiting for Congress to act, but he's not. And the Congress itself, 6 years ago, imposed a pre-funding mandate that the Postal Service pre-fund retiree health benefits 75 years in advance, which no other agency has to do and which no company would do, and certainly not in a recession, costing the Postal Service 10% of its budget every year and driving it into deficit. All I have to say about that is that we have to fight. We can't rely on Congress. We can't rely on the Postmaster General to save the Postal Service. We, the people, have to save the Postal Service. And in that regard, I'm encouraging all the listeners to get out on March 17th at 2 p.m. downtown Portland. We're going to have a massive march and rally to save America's Postal Service and save Saturday delivery. Stop the closures, stop the cuts, stop the delay of mail.
On Tuesday, House progressives offer the first and only deficit reduction plan to come out of Congress so far in 2013 that would both create jobs and avoid the budget sequestration. The Progressives' plan would maintain the $1.7 trillion in spending cuts created by the 2011 Budget Control Act. It would also replace nearly $1 trillion of planned automatic budget cuts with new revenue generated by closing loopholes and deductions for the wealthiest Americans. And it would cut defense spending by nearly $300 billion, which would then be used to create jobs by investing in infrastructure. But given the extreme partisan divide in Congress, most analysts agree that the Progressives' deficit reduction plan has very little chance of passing. At the same time, representatives have faced a lobbying blitz from the corporate group Fix the Debt. More than 80 CEOs of America's most powerful corporations, including 35 financial service firms, helped form the Fix the Debt campaign. They're holding a summit this week in Washington, D.C. The largest federation of unions in the United States, the AFL-CIO, says the corporations involved in Fix the Debt are the ones that crashed our economy, got massive bailouts, spent millions to influence the budget debate, and continue to demand even more tax breaks at the expense of families. The AFL-CIO helped organize a protest outside the Fix the Debt summit. Here's a clip from that protest.
Trying to do, they're trying to cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, cut Social Security. And why? So they can get more tax cuts for the rich, corporate tax cuts. Are we okay with that?
No! Fix the green! Fix the green!
Fix the
green!
Fix the green!
So I'm here to tell these people that the millions that they're spending to cut our safety nets, all they have to do is pay their fair share.
Ahora todos ustedes adentro escuchen. Mi nombre es Yvonne. Tienen compañías haciendo millones de dólares. Sin importar en lo que nosotros estamos sufriendo aquí. No tenemos Medicare, no tenemos Social Security, pero nosotros tampoco tenemos trabajo. No necesitamos realmente de sus servicios si no fuera porque ustedes no nos dan trabajo. Eso es lo que nos merecemos.
I'm here to speak on the Motorola solution, making over $29 billion last year. Motorola solution is part of Fix the Debt. Motorola solution wants more tax loopholes.